morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO FM. This is Norm Diamond, your host. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer and our producer. If you're just turning now into KBOO, you probably already know from the lighter-than-usual traffic or the pitter-patter of children's feet who otherwise would be in school that today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, a day we'll celebrate on the Old Mole with a program devoted to racial issues. Indeed, we'll approach race from many directions, through culture, drawing on music, if we have time, and on graphic arts. And if you're wondering how we'll do graphic arts on the radio, stay tuned. Through public policy and efforts by politicians to use racism as a stepping stone to higher office. Through debates over the teaching of history and attempts to suppress accounts of black agency by pretending an entire era didn't occur. Can you guess what era I mean? And through the creative responses of black activists and classroom teachers to the attacks and the attempts to enforce silence. In an interview we first broadcast last year on this day, Bill Resnick will talk with Malik Mia about critical race theory, what it actually means, the complex ways racism is reproduced, and how and why the right is attacking CRT in the schools and attempting to mobilize parents. Malik Mia is an aviation mechanic turned author who spent decades fighting racism in his unions. Then we'll pick up on some of their themes in today's episode of Another World is Possible. The response to the attack on CRT has had a new focus this past year, the teaching of the post-Civil War era we call Reconstruction. We'll ask how a brief period, 150 years ago, becomes a flashpoint in our modern culture wars. It becomes that focus, here's a quick clue now, if the same issues of racial equity, working class organization, and democratic control, if those same issues still exist, and if activist groups like Black Lives Matter effectively raise them yet again. We'll look at what's most important to know about Reconstruction and at the educators creatively teaching about that era in the face of organized right-wing attempted repression. Finally, Matt Witt will review a memoir by an African-American from Georgia who had a day named after him. Not MLK, but Winfred Rembert. Growing up in rural Georgia, Rembert nearly died from a lynching after joining a demonstration for voting rights. He served 7 years on a prison chain gang, but eventually became a nationally recognized artist who painted scenes from his life. Matt, I should mention, is not only a writer, but a distinguished artist in his own field of photography. Back in December, we did a memorial tribute for Staunton Lind, civil rights and labor activist who had died the previous month. Each year, Staunton sent me and others a Christmas greeting, usually a poem he had written. So I was startled to receive one this year also. It turned out to be from his wife, Alice, and contained a note from Janet Moses referring to her husband, Robert Moses, distinguished fighter for civil rights and educator, all the way from Freedom Summer in the 1960s until his recent death. I'll ask Patricia to read the note, as I'll ask her to be our reader on other occasions this morning.
Several years ago, Bob and I received an end-of-year letter from Staunton Lind and his wife, Alice. Staunton shared that he and Alice were keeping alive the embers of what was the core spirit of SNCC's work in Mississippi, despite the challenging cultural and political terrain of Ohio's Rust Belt. I continue to be struck by the idea of ember keepers, guarding the flickering embers from the vicissitudes of stormy weather, from the gargantuan feet of the stompers, from the winds of those whistling Dixie, and the flamethrowers who are energized by the fireworks but bored by the laborious details of movement building.
When Patricia says SNCC, she means, of course, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee of the 1960s and 70s. Ellis goes on to say that her and Staunton's daughter, Marta Lind Alton, wrote a poem in response.
Ember Keepers. Huddled with cupped hands, breathing faith into flickering light, remembering the best of what one has shared, lived, worked for, even struggled and failed for, moments of justice, however short-lived, bits and pieces of yes, feelings of kindness, connectedness, fairness, sharing, family times, interest in other beyond fear, boundaries of differences, fading into the we of human family, choosing to love, forgive, let go, and celebrate this passing moment of creation, not thinking it to death, remembering to behold the possibility of now and the strength to breathe into the fire.
Ellis concludes her note saying, "May we all do our part in keeping the embers alive." Now here's Bill Resnick with Malik Mia from MLK Day 2022.
Hi, Malik Mia. Welcome to KABU.
Thank you very much, Bill. I'm glad to be here.
Malik Mia is a longtime civil rights and revolutionary socialist activist, made his living as an aviation mechanic, co-wrote the books The Assassination of Malcolm X and Angola, The Hidden History of Washington's War, also contributed a chapter to the book The National Black Independent Political Party, An Important Step for Blacks and Other American Workers. He's now a contributing editor with Against the Current on the advisory board of LINX, the International Journal of Socialist Renewal. He has published several pieces recently in Green Left Weekly and also Against the Current, and recently published an article, Why Critical Race Theory is Important. So, Malik, what is critical race theory? Then we can discuss how the right wing and the Republican Party have come to use it for her purposes and often succeed. But first, give us the story of critical race theory.
Yes. Well, critical race theory is mainly a legal concept that was discussed and taught in law school going back to the 1980s. And those who presented this idea, it actually was at a workshop in 1989 that they used a term, though it's actually existed before that, the concept, that all the laws and legal institutions of the United States are rooted in structural and institutional racism. So what that means is that the structural racism is to maintain the privileges and advantage of the whites over other non-whites or African-Americans and others. And you can see it in social, economic, and political inequalities. So they looked at it from the legal point of view, the laws that have been adopted over the decades and centuries, and how that reflects that structural inequality. So that was the basic concept. And then the debate was on that level. It only became a political football, which we'll talk about recently. But that was their basic idea, which, you know, anyone who knows the history of this country knows that's actually true.
My sense is that the ideas of critical race theory have picked up by many others. In fact, they originated in much other research in the social sciences. That often happens in the law. I happen to be a lawyer and know that historians of the United States have done a huge amount of excavating, and the lawyers have just then used that to begin examining the laws. So it's been picked up by social sciences to greatly enrich critical race theory by doing specifics. And let's get concrete about it. Tell us about some of the hidden sources of racism hidden but extremely damaging in U.S. life today.
Okay, well, there's several topics, but we can begin with real estate, because real estate historically in the United States is the way that many farmers, poor workers, and others, if they could get land or property, was a way to start to accumulate what is called wealth. And historically, the right to buy land and property was African Americans or blacks were excluded from that for the most part legally, and definitely other people. You know, Native Americans were not even considered people, and for the most part. So they always say, well, if racism exists, you know, it's not because black people couldn't accumulate it because they didn't own homes or that. They decided not to. But in fact, it's been shown by historians, and I'm glad, Bill, you made that point, by studying concrete situations like urban areas and even farmland, how African Americans were excluded from owning land. And therefore, how could you accumulate wealth to pass on to your family and future generations when they wouldn't let you do it? And I'll be very concrete right now. Recently, just last week, the New York Times wrote an article about Central Park and how there were blacks who owned land in what became Central Park. And then the land, this is back in the 1800s, was taken from them to build Central Park. Now, that land would be worth millions today, but they were basically urban removed. Many people are familiar what happened after World War II with urban removal to build the freeways, and they always went through black areas, historic black areas, or Latino areas to build their freeways and take away their land or property, or even if they own homes. That definitely happened also in California, where I live. So the laws were written, redlining, as they called it, prevented certain blacks from living in certain areas. But even when they tried to buy real estate or bought land, they were removed because laws were passed to say, oh, we need this freeway, or we need this park. And it was always targeted toward minorities for the most part. It affected poor whites too, but not like it targeted African Americans. That's a very concrete example of how structural racism and laws work hand in hand. Laws were written to justify political decisions to discriminate against blacks on real estate.
Yeah. Laws have also been written to forbid discrimination in housing, that is racial discrimination in housing, and then I think they were expanded to include discrimination against women and religious discrimination, even the disabled. But despite that, what the sociologists find when they send in equally presentable black and white people responding to an ad, that is, it's an experiment. They go to the rental brokers. They find that it's overwhelming that the white person is really considered and then given a home once they talk to the landlord. And the blacks are steered only to landlords in black areas. And in fact, those laws seem not to have any teeth unless they were really enforced, but they aren't.
Yes, Bill, and that's an important point, because the most significant law on housing discrimination was adopted by Congress in 1968. Before 1968, it wasn't even an issue. You just were discriminated against. And part of the people who were the theorists of racial, you know, critical race theory looked at those laws. Okay, you passed a law in Congress. States adopted many similar laws around the country. But immediately, how they were applied continued to be discriminatory. So, for example, on housing discrimination, while if you did it openly and just said, I will not rent or sell to a black person, that was illegal. But if you did it, you know, like you said, okay, I'll take your application or real estate company, I'll look at it, and then they would just put it aside, put it in a separate basket, and wait till a white person comes. So that's how that happened. But then let's say you're in Washington, D.C., or a city that's predominantly black, or in Virginia or Maryland bordering D.C. Well, you can make sure those suburbs still discriminate even with this law. You can make it clear that, okay, the identical home could be priced lower in a black area than a white area. So you steer the to that black area, not to the white area. Now, the house values should be the same, but they aren't. This is today. So that's how those laws were undermined, which is where critical race theory became important, because they explained that. How is that possible unless it's structural, unless it's inherent to the racism in the system? There's the connection.
Malik, even when blacks are allowed to own homes or farms in particular, in one example, it turns out that when the applications for loans, and all small farmers, almost all, depend on loans at the beginning of the growing season, and then they pay back from the proceeds. That's a little risky, but that's how it works. And the big farmers, though, have big pockets, and they're often owned by corporations. So even in a bad period, small farmers are being killed of all races. But the Agriculture Department has a loan program for small farmers. It turns out, after you really study all of the papers and the applications, that black farmers were not given any money. I mean, that's court cases going on and on and on to reimburse those people, and it's very hard to find them because they've been forced off the land into the big cities. And they were successful farmers, actually. It's so complicated, but without support from the state, all small farmers go under. The Agriculture Department seemed not able to process a black farmer's application, regardless of how successful they were in past years.
No, you're right. You're right. I mean, even the new Biden administration claimed they were going to come in to correct that. And the pushback from the Republicans and the right, saying that was a form of reparations to try to make up for the past discrimination, they didn't fight back. So even the black farmers groups that exist, can I get these loans? Still can I get what they're owed from past discrimination? So that's, again, part of, to get back to our discussion on critical race theory, that's another example. You have laws, you have rules, you show how it's been used in a discriminatory way, but at the end of the day, you still don't get the benefits. It's very difficult to get justice. And that continues to this day on land and farming, as it does in other issues.
One final issue that strikes me as hard to explain, it's within the medical system. I read a study of what happens when people wind up in a hospital with a stroke. And the first thing that the emergency room people have to do is give them some aspirins or a powerful aspirins substitute that stops clotting. And the hospital people are required to do this. It's just standard in practice for any stroke. Because they have to stop clotting, they give people aspirin. And yet, when you look at the records, white people get it almost all the time, and black people do get it most of the time, but not nearly the extent to which the whites do, regardless of class or race. How is that explained?
Bill, this is an important point, because you're getting into what I call the institutional racism built in our medical schools and our universities and all institutions we have. Certain things are not taught, or certain assumptions exist about blacks that, even if you're not conscious of it, it's sort of unconscious bias, it's taught that way. So when you get into become a doctor or any field, you just bring those biases with you, and they're not checked. And I would also add, there are similar biases against women in medicine, because a lot of studies and tests never include women. They're mainly on men. And then you add the burden, if you're a black woman, it's even worse. So that's where some of this comes from, which is why it's difficult, because how are you going to prove a negative? How are you going to prove something happened to you or a family member? It was because of that bias. It's hard to do. Except, you know, later through studies. But that's the inequalities built into the system, these biases that exist, including in medicine. I did an article at the early stages of the pandemic about black women and how they're treated, including what happened to a black woman doctor and how she was treated. And they didn't listen to her when she was trying to explain what was going on. That That was not unusual. It was not unusual. It didn't matter, like you say, if you were wealthy or you were educated, you were a professional, they treated a black person differently than a white. And that's the inherent racism that exists in the system that laws alone cannot fix. And part of what the people who promote critical race theory say is what I just said. What they don't say is, what do you do about it? Or very little about that. They just explain what exists. It's a problem. We need to recognize. Most of them don't have really a solution because they accept the system as it is, meaning the for-profit system.
Hi, folks. This is your old Moral Variety Hour on KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland. Bill Resnick talking to Malik Mia. He's a long-term black rights and revolutionary socialist activist, made his living as an aviation mechanic, co-wrote a number of books, wrote hundreds of articles. The Republicans have now what they call weaponized critical race theory. They claim that critical race theory, and by that they mean any critique, actually, of whether it's of laws or any anti-racism curriculum in the schools, is really racist against whites, against America. They claim it preaches hatred and violence and calls for elimination in schools. How have they managed to get away with that? Tell us about the Republican attack, Malik Mia.
Well, yes, Bill, this is an important point. Republicans are very good at demonizing many issues, and critical race theory is easy because most people don't understand what it is. So they define it as, if you tell people about racism, therefore you're telling whites they have to be, embarrassed, or they have to be take responsibility themselves personally for the history of racism in this country. And they repeat that over and over again, and it gets people to believe that anything about history, real history of this country, any discussion about blacks as slaves, which is a fact, segregation, which was a fact, is attacking white people. So they use that simple talking point to convince parents, especially in schools, to reject any discussion. And they go after school boards and principals and others who even mention this true history. So it's a political point. They're good at it. And because the people who oppose them are not, except for black, you know, the black professionals and social class, political class, have answered them effectively, but the mainstream Democratic white leadership and others don't. So they capitulate. They say, yes, yes, we should be careful how much we discuss this. Reparations, yes, that's not what we mean. So they, by backtracking, it encourages the right to go even further to the point where they rewrite the textbooks to basically wipe out any mention of the real history. As one black student has said, you know, you go to school in Texas, and they'll tell you about maybe three black figures, Martin Luther King, maybe Malcolm X, Frederick Douglass. That's it. They don't talk about anything else in American history. And if the Republicans had their way, they wouldn't even mention those three black figures. So that's what this is about. It's a political game. They get people on the ground, and they whip up a movement, and the goal is ultimately to wipe out any of the social gains that African Americans have made in this country. When they say turn back the clock, some people say, well, okay, it's weak. You weaken voting rights, you weaken housing discrimination. No. What they mean by turning back the clock, in my view, is going back at least to the era after World War I in the 1920s, where these type of laws, anti-black racist laws, anti-immigrant laws, you can go down the list, was the norm across all 50 states. That's what they want. They want a white America that was white-run, everyone knew their place, and you had to accept that. That's their goal. Now, the defenders of those opponents of this are not explaining it the way I do, for the most part. They just say, these people are minority. That's not true. The Republicans should go back to their roots. but that's not going to happen, because this is about a white majority that is declining. They use that cultural identity crisis for some, not all, for some, to whip up a political movement to attack all social gains that have been made the last 50 years. And that's their goal. And if we don't stop it, could we go to an authoritarian state as Trump tries? Yes, I believe it can happen. I definitely believe it can happen.
Mark, me, a longtime black civil rights and revolutionary socialist activist. Malik, we can't end on such a pessimistic note. It seems to me that the Republican effort could be stopped. To be sure, Trump or someone resembling Trump getting his blessing and putting together the same old right-wing white supremacist team, they could, in fact, prevail in the next election. And they're doing quite well in Congress and in the states and in suppressing the vote of poor people and working people. We'll talk about that in another interview, Malik. Tell us, what's your sense of the near future and what can be done to defeat the white supremacists and the Trumpists?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to recognize you're not going to defeat the authoritarian movement that Trump represents by elections or laws. You have to have a mass movement, mass response in the streets around these different issues that we've been talking about. In the 1960s, just a reminder, we had a Democratic president, JFK, John F. Kennedy, and then followed by Johnson. And their main approach to the civil rights era movement, which was in the streets, fighting in the South to end Jim Crow segregation, fighting in the North where we had redlining and discrimination, was to basically tell King and others to slow down, to wait for them. And Martin Luther King and the Black Rights Movement basically said, no, we can't wait. They kept demonstrations. They kept protests. They kept going to the South. They had the March on Washington in 1963. All that mass pressure is what led the Democrats, who controlled the government completely, but it was split between the Southern Democrats, what are Dixiecrats, and the Northern Democrats. They finally pushed through those civil rights laws that are being undermined, voting rights, civil rights, and the housing rights. But that was the answer. Well, the answer wasn't say we got to wait to get more elected people in office. And this is important to remember. There were very few blacks elected to office in the 60s because you couldn't run for office for the most part. They were not elected like today. A lot more are elected. So they just kept the pressure on, and they challenged the state. And then you had rebellions in 67, 65, 67, 68 in urban areas. All that combined is what led to some of the changes in laws and changes that are important, that led to the revived women's movement, the gay liberation movement, other minority groups protesting. So it was through the mass struggle for basic democratic rights that led to change. That's what's missing today. We don't have that yet. We had the Black Lives Matter movement, which is still around, but not what it was in the 2020 protests. But that's what we need. If that happens, you can make progress. You can stop these attacks. You can defend it. If it doesn't happen, we're going to have to take more big setbacks. That's to finally galvanize that kind of movement. Will it happen? I'll give you a positive. In the last 6 months, we've seen labor organizations and unions start to fight back for better wages, better working conditions across the country, especially low-wage workers. Nobody could have predicted that. But labor, which has always been weak over the last 20, 30 years, is trying to get revitalized. A lot of those labor workers are blacks, Latino, minority workers, white workers who had enough. Now, that is important part of the picture that's not rarely talked about by the mass media, big business media. To me, that's an important sign that we can have the type of unity between all workers, whatever their race, to stand up to the bosses. and that can help inspire the broader social movements. So I believe that's the future. May not happen in the 2022 elections or even 2024, but that kind of mass movement is what will turn the tide.
Now, Mia, thanks so much for talking to us. As a conclusion, tell the people listening to KVU where your writing can be found.
Yes, domestically, Against the Current magazine out of Detroit. I write regularly for that. And then internationally, I write for an Australian paper called Green Left Weekly, at least twice a month, on various topics. I partly do that because they're one of the largest left publications in the Pacific, and their article, they get around. Some of my articles are also published in Europe. But the main domestic one is Against the Current magazine, and then those are the two publications I mainly write for.
Malik Mia, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much, Bill. I enjoyed it.
Mr. Backlash, just who do you think I am? You raise my taxes, freeze my wages, and send my son to Vietnam. You give me second-class houses and second-class schools. Do you think that all colored folks are just second-class fools, Mr. Backlash?
That was Nina Simone, of course, with Backlash Blues. And now, another world is possible. There are political revolutions, and there are social revolutions. Sometimes they're combined, as in the case of the Russian Revolution, which both overthrew the Tsar and attempted to transform the economic system and class relations. And sometimes, historically, you get just one kind or the other. What gets called the American Revolution, for instance, was primarily political. There were activists within it who fought for larger change, for redistributing the wealth, for instance, even for racial, if not gender, equality. But the outcome was a political revolution, independence from Great Britain, and not much of a social revolution. The U.S. effort at fundamental social transformation came later, 90 or so years after the political revolution. Unfortunately for us, it was defeated. I'm talking about the period of a few years during and after the Civil War that we call Reconstruction, arguably the key turning point in U.S. history, which is why 150 years later, that period, Reconstruction, has become a flashpoint now in the cultural wars of our own times. So how do events of that long ago become grist for right-wing media hosts and think tanks, for denunciations in state legislatures and mean-spirited talking points for governors running for higher office? They take on that prominence if, one, the same issues of racial equality, democratic control, and working-class organization remain unresolved, and two, those issues are being raised with effectiveness by activist groups. Today, as we celebrate the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., it's in the context of what might have been if the Reconstruction struggle had won, and what of its legacy should still encourage our own struggles. What then was Reconstruction? And in the current debates over its meaning, what is it important for us to get across? Reconstruction, then, is our case study in today's episode of Another World is Possible. That was our theme music, We Have the Guillotine, performed by the coup. Let me start with a personal anecdote that connects Martin Luther King Jr. with the opposition we sometimes encounter in schools against the teaching of racial justice. Sometime in the early 1990s, I was in Atlanta and stopped to see Coretta Scott King, Martin's widow, whom I knew from having taught at an institution where she served on the board. Hearing a bit about my family, she gave me a large framed portrait of Martin as a gift for my son's elementary school here in Portland. Given the extent to which MLK's image had already been tamed and co-opted, his revolutionary intentions distorted into a bland homily about nonviolence, I thought the school would welcome the gift. Instead, I was given to understand that the portrait of a black man who organized for social and economic change might be offensive to some of the parents. This was not quite stated explicitly, only that the school preferred to avoid controversy. The portrait was stuck away in a closet in the principal's office and never hung. That controversy, on the vastly greater national scale, has come out of the closet. Thanks to Black Lives Matter and the uprising about policing black communities, a range of issues connected to race are now part of widespread public contentiousness. Among those issues have been debates over school curricula. We are now riven by widespread attempts to shout down school boards or take them over, to ban books and gag teachers, and efforts by governors and state legislatures to meddle with the specifics of classroom content. Last week's debacle in the U.S. Congress had Representative McCarthy denouncing what he called woke indoctrination as part of his campaign to become Speaker of the House. These reactionary attacks have an additional subtext. They're part of the larger effort to do away with public education entirely. Some of the reaction against Black Lives Matter first took the form of an attack on critical race theory, originally an academic approach in law schools to investigate how institutions in our society perpetuate racial disparity, now turned into a right-wing catch-all phrase for any teaching about the existence and consequences of racism. More recently, part of that controversy has focused on how we understand the history, the defeated opportunity, the inspiration of Reconstruction, the history of an attempted revolution, the history that's been suppressed. W.E.B. Du Bois wrote a magisterial book on Reconstruction way back in the 1930s. Much of what I know about the era comes from his book, Black Reconstruction in America, 1860 to 1880. But the history he uncovered was not what the powers that be wanted told. Here's Du Bois recounting just one instance of the censorship he encountered.
The editors of the 14th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica asked me for an article on the history of the American Negro. From my manuscript, they cut out all my references to Reconstruction. I insisted on including the following statement. White historians have ascribed the faults and failures of Reconstruction to Negro ignorance and corruption. But the Negro insists that it was Negro loyalty and the Negro vote alone that restored the South to the Union, established the new democracy both for white and black, and instituted public schools. The editor refused to print it. I was not satisfied and refused to allow the article to appear.
Thank you, Patricia. Reading from Du Bois. Reconstruction wasn't taught in schools or was barely taught until recently. If mentioned at all in an American history class, it was done dismissively as a sort of victim blaming. Freed slaves, the common teaching went, were given the vote, but proved incompetent in its exercise. But that's a history both minimized and distorted. Think of the sentence I just said, freed slaves, as if freedom was something granted, as distinct from black working people playing a major role in freeing themselves, as if freedom is simply a legal status, and people could be free in the harsh economic circumstances that resulted with few resources. Given the vote, again presenting black working people as passive recipients of the action and generosity of others. Proved incompetent in exercising the vote. Well, that's simply a convenient, self-serving lie. But classroom practice is changing. Thanks to the outstanding efforts of the Zinn Education Project, the journal Rethinking Schools, and the organization Teaching for Change, thousands of teachers across the country have publicly pledged they'll not be intimidated. For many, teaching a fuller, more accurate version of Reconstruction is a way to equip students to understand and respond to the issues of our own times. It's a way also to show that historical outcomes aren't inevitable, that history could have turned out differently, and that what happens now and in the future is at least partly dependent on our own efforts. That's where I'd start, where I'm teaching now, or at least aim at as the basic understanding, that Reconstruction was a revolutionary period, ultimately an opportunity lost, a key epoch in determining the struggles of today. A basic reinterpretation of Reconstruction starts with recognizing the agency of the people who were enslaved, their own role in freeing themselves. Du Bois used the term general strike in characterizing the work stoppage of hundreds of thousands of slaves that cut off supplies to Confederate troops, that guided the Union armies, that left plantations and seaports and workshops to join the Union forces, even serving with distinction in the Union Army. The emancipation we celebrate on Juneteenth was not only a grant by President Lincoln, but Lincoln's response to the many, many former slaves who had already freed themselves. It was, among other reasons, a result of Lincoln's recognition that the Union needed black soldiers to win the war. Agency, that is, black people acting on their own behalf and on behalf of others, and not simply being the recipients of others' actions, is an even bigger part of the Reconstruction story. Leadership among the rebellious slaves came extensively from fugitives, slaves who had fled earlier, and from blacks who had not been slaves. Already during the war, blacks self-organized communities of former slaves, sometimes with the aid of the Union Army and government, sometimes having to force Union acceptance. These communities were rehearsals for the black leadership in southern states that followed the war. I mentioned President Lincoln. He's become a symbol around the world for the freedom struggle he partly facilitated, partly only tolerated. Taking a break in our discussion, here's an excerpt from a Pablo Neruda poem relating anti-imperialist struggles now to the 19th century struggle of U.S. slaves. It's an effort to remind those of us in the heart of imperialism of Lincoln's legacy. Let the rail splitter awake. Again, presented by Patricia.
If you arm your hordes, North America, to destroy that pure frontier and bring the butcher from Chicago to govern the music and the order that we love, we'll rise from the stones in the air to bite you. We'll rise from the last window to pour fire on you. We'll rise from the deepest waves to sting you with spines. We'll rise from the furrow so that the seed will pound you like a Colombian fist. We'll rise to deny you bread and water. We'll rise to burn you in hell. Let none of this come to pass. Let the rail splitter awake. Let Abe come, let his aged yeast raise the green and gold earth of Illinois. Let him lift up his axe in his own town against the new slaveholders, against the slave lash, against the poisoned printing press, against the bloodied merchandise they want to sell. Let them march, singing and smiling, the young white, the young Negro, against the walls of gold, against the manufacturer of hate, against the merchant of their blood. Let them sing, laugh, and conquer. Let the rail splitter awake.
The rail splitter, of course, was Abraham Lincoln. Equally important on the question of agency was the contribution of black people after the war. Far from a story of incompetence, a lie that's been created to justify not only Ku Klux Klan depredations and racist laws, but also the suppression of the revolutionary potential of Reconstruction. Blacks played prominent and progressive roles in governance. For instance, creating public school systems in the South, where there had been barely any, expanding the right to serve on juries and to vote, enhancing women's rights to own property, progressive taxation, making the state more responsive to social needs. All of these, incidentally, were benefits to poor whites as well as to blacks. This is why Du Bois called Reconstruction the finest effort to achieve democracy for the working class, ever. And that's where some of the opposition came from. Enhanced services required taxing the remaining Southern wealthy to pay for them. Northern capital, flooding into the South, wanted a continuing supply of cheap labor. Poor Southern whites had to choose whether their allegiances were to other workers or to wealthier whites. Class and race allegiances in extended opposition to each other. Clearly, there's a lot more to say about Reconstruction, about how it was defeated, about the role and weaknesses of the abolitionist movement, about the ambiguous response of the organized white worker movement, both North and South, and about 150 years worth of attempts to suppress the real history. I'll come back to that history in another episode of Another World is Possible. Meanwhile, a lot of creativity is going into the teaching. I'd like to introduce you to just a bit of it now and come back to more examples of powerful pedagogy around Reconstruction, also in that future episode. Imagine a classroom. It's well into the term. The students have already studied slavery and the Civil War. Through role plays and simulations and other practices, they've developed confidence that classmates and teachers listen to them respectfully and that their own disagreements can illuminate the history they're studying. They're gaining the sense that looking at dilemmas and tough choices can be a better way to understand the past than memorizing a textbook's dates and interpretations. Now imagine that every student in the class is asked to take on the perspective of a former slave at the conclusion of the Civil War. Imagine that you're one of those students. You get to decide some aspects of your role. For instance, you may or may not have heard the demand for 40 acres and a mule, for the resources to get a new start. Is that a new start for you alone, or do you have a family? Perhaps you're searching for family members who were sold away. Now that you're set in your role, the teacher poses questions for you to think about and discuss. If you were given the right to the land you had spent your life working, would you be willing, in exchange for that land, to promise that you'd continue growing cotton for Northern capital? What safeguards should there be for you before the Confederate States are readmitted to the Union? Should people who were disloyal to the United States be allowed to vote Should women? Notice that these are not right or wrong questions. Rather, they're entry points to the heart of the history. After hashing them out in class, as if you were part of a convention of the newly freed, you step out of your role, and the teacher introduces the class to the primary sources. You may be surprised at how the history differs from your expectations, and that surprise may raise yet further questions for you. Having already explored some of the difficult decisions that constitute the history, you and your classmates are much better equipped to understand what actually happened in that era. Perhaps you are better equipped as well to appreciate the tough choices and responsibilities in our own times. This has been Norm Diamond, Another World is Possible, for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Before moving on to our last segment, I want to acknowledge that the teaching experiences I riffed on were lesson plans by Bill Bigelow, Mimi Eisen, and Ursula Wolf Rocha. They and other wonderful classroom practices can be found at the Zen Education Project website. I'll give you more examples in a future Old Mole. Now, Matt Witt on Winfred Rembert.
With the Martin Luther King holiday approaching, I've been thinking about Winfred Rembert, another African-American from Georgia who had a day named after him. I had never heard of Winfred Rembert until I read his recent memoir called Chasing Me to My Grave, and you probably haven't either. But his life and his memoir are well worth knowing about. 11 years ago, the mayor of his hometown of 3,000, called Cuthbert in rural Georgia, declared Winfred Rembert Day and presented Rembert with a plaque honoring the fact that he had become a distinguished artist. The plaque said that Rembert refuses to allow the chains of hatred for injustice to hold him a prisoner of the past. I'm actually not sure what that means, and neither was Rembert himself. But his wife, Patty, told him that she knew. The mayor knows they were wrong for what they did to you, she told him. Giving you a day was his way to keep you from asking them to give an account of the wrong they done. It's a way to hide it. The wrongs done to Winfred Rembert started when he was born as a black child in the South after World War II. Instead of being given an education, he was put to work at age 5, picking cotton for a local plantation owner. As a teenager in the 1960s, he met some courageous black civil rights organizers who were mobilizing other black residents to demand the right to vote, something few of them did because trying to vote could result in losing your job or your living quarters or even your life. Rembert went to a voter rights demonstration that was attacked by sheriff's deputies with dogs, the fire department with high-powered water hoses, and eventually a white mob with shotguns and billy clubs. Rembert fled to escape the violence but was caught by police and held in jail for more than a year without bail and without charges even being filed. Eventually, he escaped. And this time, when he was caught by sheriff's deputies, they lynched him, hung him from a tree, and mutilated him with a knife. He would have died right there, but at the last minute, one of the deputy's bosses said they had done enough and that they should take Rembert down from the tree and back to the jail. After he was paraded through town in chains, he was sentenced to 7 years in state prison, where he spent much of his time working on a chain gang operated for profit by a prison administrator. In prison, Rembert learned how to make paintings on leather. And after he got out, he got married, moved north, and eventually gained well-deserved recognition as a talented artist. His memoir includes more than 75 of his visually stunning paintings that show scenes from his life. He depicts the brutality he faced from white supremacists, but also the liveliness of the black community he grew up in, and the love he felt for his wife and for his great aunt who raised him. His art has been featured in galleries and purchased by private collectors all over the country. In his memoir, he writes, "I had always thought negative about my artwork. Why would anyone want a picture of me riding on my mama's cotton sack? Why would anyone want a picture of me shooting pool in the pool room?" So when people bought the pictures and hung them in their homes, it was out of the realm of anything I thought would ever happen. Winfred Rembert died 2 years ago, shortly before the official publication date of his memoir, Chasing Me to My Grave. He knew that by organizing, Black people and their allies had won some progress in Georgia and in the country in general since he was a kid in Cuthbert. But Rembert's heartfelt story and powerful artwork serve as a reminder that battles for racial and economic justice, and even for the right to vote, continue to this day.
That's our program for this Monday morn, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Thanks to Old Moles Bill Resnick, Patricia Kohlberg, and Matt Witt, and Bill's guest, Malik Mia. Thanks always to the much-appreciated KBOO staff. Have a good rest of the holiday, and catch us again next Monday. Till then, stay safe and stay active.
When I try to find a job to earn a little cash, all you got to offer is your mean old white backlash. But the world is big, big and bright and round, and it's full of folks like me who are black, yellow, beige and brown. Mr. Backlash, I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blue. Mr. Backlash, Mr. Backlash, just what do you think I got to lose? I'm gonna leave you with the backlash blues.